This is part two for show seven of the Retro Computing Roundtable. Well, so the last three things are mostly announcements. One, we can discuss this one, might be interesting, the Life magazine article. So another slideshow, the brief history of computing.
Yeah, these are always great.
Nice photos.
Way back. Very nice photos. Always like to, they always like to include the Enigma. It was the Enigma, I guess because of the Colossus or whatever, but the Enigma itself wasn't really a, I mean, part of computer history, was it?
Well, it wasn't a computer. It was a machine.
Yeah.
I mean, but it took a computer to crack it.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, then they have the ENIAC and the UNIVAC one. Yeah, with the UNIVAC one, I love those the tape drives, you know, the tape reels there with the kind of curved glass closure at the top. What a neat-looking computer room. And you see the next one is 1952 about the election. So that ties in. Goes in transistors. Oh, the mouse. And video games. Apple One. Steve's PC. I mean, so it really kind of jumps. And the Mac. So, you know, it's not about trying to show you anything with Commodores or TRS-80s or any of that sort of stuff.
And they never do, do they?
No. No, it's kind of like, Evan, what did you call it? Sort of a...
I believe I said dummy down.
Yeah.
There was a wonderful... Have you guys ever heard of Mike Mahoney?
I don't think so.
Michael Mahoney, yeah.
Oh.
Michael was a historian at Princeton University who died a couple of years ago, and he was very active in that Society for History of Technology I mentioned a little while ago, the academic group. And he wrote a book called The Many – well, I don't know if it was a book or a paper, but he wrote a famous paper in computer history called The Many Histories of Computing. And it talks about how computer history has many, many parallel universes, not just what you just discussed. You know, it's not a straight line from ENIAC to Microsoft. And The Many Histories of Computing goes off in 47 different branches and people and machines and software, and it's not just, you know, six computers – from ENIAC to UNIVAC to Altair to Microsoft. Real life doesn't work that way.
Right.
So it's very recommended reading if you're looking for something heavy. But it also makes the point here that those mass market histories do get to be frustrating sometimes for us.
Well, which brings us to another slideshow or a list, the 25 most important PCs in history by Maximum PC. So with the Ken Back one being, by most accounts, this was the first PC.
I thought that was cool that they had that on there. I mean, I know that there's some controversy about what is exactly considered the first personal computer, but a lot of people think it was this one, the Ken Back one. And I thought it was neat. They had a nice photo of that on there, too.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with the link.
Well, that's what Bruce Damer said last show.
Yes.
The Lincoln Labs one?
Yes.
The MIT?
Uh-huh. Yes.
See, but it comes down to, you know, how do you define personal computer, which in its simplest, you know, most obvious, if you will, definition, well, it's a computer for one person to use, a personal one. But I guess a lot of us, we tend to think of a, you know, a home computer, a consumer computer as being a personal
right.
computer.
And there's so many variables. I mean, there's personal computing, which is different from personal computer, you know, hardware and software are different issues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one person can still use it, but it still might be a multi-user machine. One person uses it at a time. So there's a lot of asterisks there. Plus those lists are all, I mean, quite frankly, a lot of those lists in modern computer magazines are highly subjective and written by a 24-year-old who looked on Wikipedia and called her research.
Yeah.
And so I think those lists – I get annoyed. I mean, not to pick on the guy who posted that link on my own group's list, but – I get annoyed at those because it just, to me, is a waste of, you know, waste of brain power. I think there's better things to talk about than those lists, in my opinion.
And actually, this 25 most important is actually a pretty good list in a lot of ways. But of course, I guess where it gets iffy and messy or whatever is when it gets into the, you know, the mid 80s or, you know, it leaves Amiga out and, well, I think someone said TI-99 and...
Right, and those lists, I mean, even
which
if they...
are they that important? I mean, maybe, but...
Even if one of those lists is well-researched, they never say how. They never say most important by what metric.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
and
I see where it stops at 81.
There is no metric. It's just some guy's opinion. You know? And it will be one thing, you know, if Gordon Bell made a list or Paul Allen made a list, it would have some credence because that's a guy who's been there and done, you know. But Maximum PC makes a list. What do they know, Frank?
And lastly, it's mostly an announcement, but is a new podcast by Ken Gagne. You know, he wrote me an email. He does not, because I mentioned it last time, that he does not, like, sponsor or he doesn't do the whole Kansas Fest on his own. Let's see, what is it? He's, like, part of their PR. I wanted to mention that. Anyway, he plays a big role in the Kansas Fest, though it's not completely his own baby. But he also does a 2GS magazine, Juice GS, it's called, and he has a very good blog. So he has now a new Apple podcast called Open Apple, an Apple II podcast. There's been one episode, and it is him and Mike McGinnis.
That should be very good, because anything Ken does is very high-quality work. Mm-hmm. I haven't had a chance to ask him, did he talk about how he anticipates it being different from existing Apple II podcasts?
Oh, you know, I listen to it, and I listen to it a lot of times on the way, you know, my commute. And I think he does, and this is right after it came out, so I don't remember, and I listen to so many podcasts, so that's good or bad. But I think he kind of addresses it, but I couldn't tell you exactly now, not having just recently listened to it. He does mention other podcasts, though, and I think, I do believe they discuss a little bit how their podcast kind of nicely accentuates or fits in with, for instance, Carrington's 1 Megahertz, and there was another one that it has been updated in a while.
A2 Unplugged.
Yeah, thank you. A2 Unplugged. And then, you know, he mentioned this podcast, which was very nice, and also, Earl, I believe yours. Did you listen to it, Earl?
I haven't heard it yet. It's on my list of things for today, actually.
I believe they mentioned a number of other podcasts, so check it out. So next we're going to talk about the eBay auctions. We just had three from last time. Bruce Damer didn't have a chance to pick one out, so I let him slide. So the first one is by Carrington Vanston, and it's Doc's Encyclopedia of Nintendo Game Instructions. And I guess it still hadn't sold, I think, because we also discussed how you can find this fairly easily in some of the used book markets, you know, for a lot cheaper. So just to discuss that again, it's always worth, utilize eBay as a place to find books, but then I would always check Amazon first and look at their used market and A-Books. And there's a great link that I've put in the other show notes where, I can't remember what it's called now, but it'll kind of do across-the-board search. So anytime you're looking for a used book.
Yeah, that was the one I told you about. That was used.atall.net.
There you go. Yeah, you told me. Yeah, great. That's definitely my preferred search now.
And that's interesting you mentioned that, David, because as I was looking through for this week for eBay, for this episode, I found a book that I actually have in my collection that on eBay they wanted $20 for, and I was thinking, I know I didn't pay $20 for that. So I got on Amazon and found it on used books as cheap as $4. So,
what book was it?
Yeah.
It's Fortran 4 with Watt 4 and Watt 5. It's a book by Kress.
Okay.
Kress was the main author. It's a green from the mid-70s, I think. Mm-hmm. Can't remember the exact date, but I used that book when I was in middle school. So I just wanted to own a copy myself because, you know, a little personal history. But it just in general, though, you're right. You know, before you actually plunk down the cash on eBay for a book, you should always check the other sources.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's funny how eBay, in some senses, maybe with some items and maybe books even, it's become a it has a small impulse buy convenient market there, which isn't the best place to buy things. You like a book like that, you might think, oh, it's on eBay, it's got to be a better deal. Some people might believe that and just go for it.
There was the one I talked about a couple weeks ago. It was like $30 or something. It was by Saul, what's his name?
Oh, Leslie Solomon.
Leslie Solomon and Stan V.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. I never heard that book, but I figured, hey, those guys write it. It's got to be a great book. And I just happened to look on the used site, and it was like $4.
Right. So we discussed
that's
this. That's
no deal at all. That's getting screwed. You know?
Yeah.
I think most of the time you're going to find it a lot cheaper on Amazon, where people will just have, you know, they're just book liquidators.
The next item was by Michael Nadeau, and it has not sold either. It has a $5,000 buy it now, so it was the vintage Sword computer system. So, yeah, we discussed that in detail. The last one was my, not really an item. I just did, I just looked into the vintage computing category, and I listed by most expensive first. So nothing really more to report there other than you could take a quick look and see.
You know, I looked at that. I saw that K-Pro 2 for $35,000.
It hasn't sold yet?
I have a K Pro 2 in my garage, and I'm like, wow, $35,000.
It's been there forever.
Yeah, you're rich.
I believe they claim it's serial number one.
Oh.
But even if that's true,
$35,000.
I mean, as a premium, obviously, but not $35,000. That's just nuts.
And so, for instance, like that sword comes up on this first page of results here, $5,000. Now, there is something new here. That wasn't here last time. That, you know, $10,000, but a vintage Varian Data Machines, you know, front panel machine. It's kind of interesting looking, but you know, $10,000. Look at picture for more info. That's what the description says.
Mm.
Wow, the pictures tell me enough. Where do I buy? All right, so moving along to this week's auctions, we're going to start off with Matt.
Sure. This, you know, obviously, I mean, this is kind of my era, the 486 machines. The reason why I picked this one, for one, it's $350, which I would never pay that much for it. But the idea of this is that, you know, for someone that is really into playing, you know, some of the old games, the DOS games, or running, you know, Windows 3.1 or DOS, and this is like the ideal machine. You know, during this time, it was 486, DX2, 66 megahertz, 32 megs of RAM, which 32 megs of RAM is a little high. You know, you really don't need that much, but it's got a 500 meg hard drive, graphics card, 16-bit sound card. Like, this is the... There's a large group of people that really enjoy having the actual hardware to play the old games on. You know, otherwise you're using an emulator, the DOS box,
right?
Emulator program, which is awesome, and you know, it's amazing. But if you really want to have the actual hardware, and I have a few of these systems that are like this, the 486s, you know. But I think that they're trying to charge $350 for it because it says it's clean, that it's in very good condition.
Yeah, seller refurbished.
It's got every single thing that you could want. But literally, I would pay $5 for this system. I mean, you know, there's so many PCs like this that, I mean, even back, I lived in Seattle for a while, and you could still find some of these old 386 and 486 machines in the local computer shops that people had just gotten rid of, and they would be for $20, $25. So
I think that's changing, though. I mean, in no way do I believe this is worth $350, but in fairness, it depends on where you live, and I think that's changing a lot, you know, where it's harder and harder. It's going to continue to get harder and harder to find them. And so it's got some value, but yeah, it's not worth that much.
I think that with all of, you know, with, you know, vintage computer collecting, everything gets to be a point where you can't find it anymore. And I think that that's what you mentioned a while back, or one of the podcasts I was, is the idea that, you know, we used to be able to go to flea markets and yard sales. And I've seen this over the years that you just can't find this stuff anymore,
right?
That you would at very cheap. You know, like I picked up a Commodore 128 a few years ago, but it's like, that's impossible to find that stuff anymore.
Yeah.
So then it goes up in price on eBay. So
now, one thing that's kind of, I think it's a little interesting, significant about this machine. Again, it doesn't make it worth $350. It has one of those Intel overdrives in it. So that means that it originally was, I guess, a 486, could have been just a DX33.
It looks like, I don't know if they, where they bumped it up to a Pentium, basically. But I don't know if it...
I see. It's a Pentium. You're right.
Well, it says that on the fan, the sticker on the fan, but he's still listed as a 486 processor. So I don't know if that's true or not. But yeah, I mean, this is like a classic machine of that era. You know, that's why, you know, my podcast is Boring Beige Box. That's all, you know, this is what the computers were back then. You know, they looked very boring, you know, and they were all
until
beige.
Steve Jobs rained on your party.
Right, yeah, when he came out with the iMac, you know, that was the big thing. And that actual term, boring beige box, actually comes from a Mac person, mm-hmm. or an Apple-type person, or a reporter that was actually commenting on all of the bad years of Apple during the 90s with the Performas and all the different ones they came out with. And then, yeah, Jobs just changed everything. So, and now all the computers are black. Right.
Right.
Or some other
silver.
The one I'm using right now is a boring beige box.
Oh, there you go. So yeah, there's a lot, you know, I've begun to see a more increase on eBay of some of these machines, but literally, I mean, you're going to pay more in shipping for any of these, you know, so you might as well just go and look, try to find them in garage sales. So
yeah, I don't see where this guy is. It would be $39 to ship to me.
Yeah, it's there's no way. I mean, but people, I mean, like you said, I mean, it's very, maybe, you know, the collector, he's really cleaned it up. It's all exactly perfect how you want it. And maybe it's worth that much to you.
So moving on to Evan, to your item is an original Altair. I noticed this guy has zero feedback.
Yeah, that's pretty fishy. But it says early version. That's not true, though. I mean, this is not an early version. It's just an early low serial number. It's not an early version. Same Altair as any other 8800. But it seems cheap. And I was wondering, you know, zero feedback, is that price too good to be true? Is there a catch? I don't know. But the price is what caught my eye. It sounds a little too good to be true.
Oh, it doesn't have a whole lot in it, does it? So it's just got three boards?
That's true, but one of them is memory, one's a CPU. Yeah. I mean,
it's got the basics.
You could use it, but again, I don't know. I would do my homework and I'd do a diligence before buying that one, because I always learned, you know, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Now, again, it's not exactly a full system, no manuals or anything like that, but that price seems pretty low for a clean Altair, in my opinion.
Check out how it has the different color little caps on the switches. I don't know if
I didn't notice that. Let me take a little look. I didn't notice that.
Yeah. I don't think I've seen that before, but it's not like I've seen that many Altairs, really. I've seen lots of pictures of them.
Is there any estimate of how many Altairs are still in existence, the 8800s?
I don't know how many, but they're not that hard to find. Yeah, that's weird. The caps there, that's not normal at all. I'd never know. That's weird. They're supposed to be all silver.
Mm-hmm. Whoa. Maybe they are. Maybe those are just some aftermarket colored caps that they put on there.
I did not notice that at all. Thank you for pointing. It looks like a Christmas tree.
Is there anything, the particular order the colors are in, is that meaningful?
No. No, there's not. They look pretty random to me. Maybe they meant something to the previous owner, but I did not notice that. I'm glad you pointed it out. That's really strange. And again, the zero feedback is... Maybe that's why it's so cheap. Maybe there's some catch. Maybe it's a scam. Who knows?
Hmm. Oh, and so, Matt, what you're saying, I don't know if I've ever heard anything. How many Altairs were manufactured? Because I did a fairly long article about Ed Roberts when he died, and I think I thought maybe it said something about how many original Altairs were made.
I know, it was a lot, but I just don't know how many.
How many resistance, yeah.
Right.
They're not really that hard to find, though.
Isn't there like an Altair, like, or at least there used to be a list or something like a web page where people had like an owner's list that would mean everybody in the world that really has one would sign up for it. But I thought there's maybe a good place to the start in such a look. I mean, other than Google, obviously, would be virtualaltair.com. He's got quite a bit of information there. He actually has a copy of the, you know, I interviewed Ed Roberts years ago, and there's the audio version of that can be found there. And let's see.
There's also a pretty active Altair Yahoo group, I believe.
Very good. Be interesting to see how it goes. So, Earl, so next up is you with a significant device, the Teletype Model 33.
Yeah, the ASR33. I always wanted one. I tell you, I love printing terminals just in general. It's just, you know, one of the things that feels the most retro to me for whatever reason. And if I could have two of them in my collection, one would be this particular model, the ASR33, and the other would be a deck writer, the standing deck printing terminal. And, you know, I used an ASR33 in high school. This is what we used with an acoustic coupler to tie into the timesharing system downtown in L.A. But the thing that I thought was the most interesting about this auction, well, first off, the high-res pictures. There are some really nice pictures of the machine.
Yeah.
And I've seen, you know, pictures of ASR33s in all different conditions. You know, occasionally you'll see one in a collection that's pristine. I don't know, maybe Evan, you guys have one that's in really good shape.
We do, and we have about 15 that are beat the heck.
And that's about the ratio that I've seen of the ones that I've seen online. It's like, yeah, occasionally you'll see one that's beautiful. Most of the time you see ones that have just, you know, been through the war,
And the one we have that's beautiful is not mint. It was actually, we got it in okay condition. It was restored by one of our members. And even now, it's pristine. The only problem with it is, you know how on the right side, they have the little panel on top screwed on for the power supply underneath it? The four buttons. The previous owner had changed that configuration so the buttons are facing the opposite direction. And it's a small thing, but it stands out as kind of a blemish on an otherwise pristine machine.
But, I mean, this one I looked at and I thought with a little bit of work, you could probably – I mean, this one in this auction, it seemed like a reasonable price. And it probably cost an absolute arm and a leg to ship because these things are super – what were they, 70 pounds? I think something
about
like that.
I carried a few and not for a long distance.
Yeah. But I mean, this one looked nice. Had a little bit of yellowing, but not bad. The keycaps looked pretty decent. They said when it was put into storage, it was working. That's no indication of whether it's working now.
Yeah, I was
wondering
about that. Like, how come they're being a little unclear about its condition? I mean, turn the thing on. Does it come on?
Yeah, and I guess there's a local button that you can hit that'll then, you know, put it in local mode and you can use it like a typewriter.
Or you could do a loop back, yeah.
Yeah. So they could probably test it if they were a mind to. But, I mean, they're not selling it for a lot of money. And, you know, I mean, even if you wanted to buy it. Now, I don't know what you would pay for one typically in this condition. I don't see that many of them to actually know.
That's a good price to me. I mean, I'm 210 miles away from it, so I could literally.
What is the price?
Like $200-something buy it now? Let me go back.
The starting bid's 200, and if you want, you can buy it now for 274, and they say they're open to whatever kind of creative shipping arrangements you want to make. So I just thought it was, you know, fair deal, and it was really interesting to me. I wish I was closer.
It looks very clean. Did you notice, Earl, if you scroll down, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. Anyway, when they do the close-up of the paper tape little compartment there, it looks like they took the lid off. And there's like a spring. And do you see? It looks like the paper tape's all bunched up in there.
Oh, I see what you're talking about. No, I think that might just be the little cover that goes over the top to guide the paper down into the.
Yeah. Next time you have Bill Denton on your show, Dave, ask him. He restored one recently, and he had a story that he was almost done restoring it, and he dropped it.
Oh, God.
And parts went everywhere. But he also had a story that he dropped it. Basically on his son.
Oh, no.
And half his brain was thinking, oh, my God, my son. Half his brain was thinking, oh, my God, parts are everywhere. How am I ever going to restore this thing again? So it might have been different stories, though, but they'll run together in my mind.
His son was okay?
Yeah. But I think part of his brain was thinking, the teletype. Yeah.
Did he fix it?
The son or the teletype?
Yeah, the teletype.
I think he might have fixed his son and then gone to, you know, killed himself. But yes, he did. He did get it working. Yes.
Yeah. How do you explain that to the wife too, huh? The mother.
No comment. His wife is a very nice woman.
Yeah, I would love to have something like this. Not that I could probably do much, you know, figure it out or do things with it. But
well, I mean, you could probably, if you got, you know, some way to talk to it. I think these things could talk current loop or RS-232. And I don't know, I might be talking out of school. Evan, you can probably correct me if I'm wrong. But
no, you're right. I mean, it's, you know, if you have a working S-100 computer, they're not that hard to interface. The big issue is making, you know, a lot. The big issue is narrowing down where the problems are, which side they're on. Once you do that, it's not that hard. Getting parts of them is interesting too.
Well, and the fact that, I mean, you really need to do regular maintenance on something like this. And if I remember reading right, the service manual says there's 500 different oil points that you have to actually apply lubrication inside this thing. So it's not trivial, actually, to keep an ASR-33 operating tip-top shape for years and years. So.
But once they are operating, they are fairly sturdy.
Yeah. Yeah, they're bulletproof. So anyway, thought that was an interesting auction. Would actually love to have one someday.
Well, I'll give a little tip. It is, can't guarantee it, but it's feasible that we may be selling some of our used ones at VCF.
Mm.
But they're going to be serious restoration projects.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Earl being in Oregon.
Yeah.
You could, if you leave,
it's quite the shipping cost.
If you start walking now,
just leave a few days ahead of time. Yeah, start driving a few days ahead.
Hey, we've had people come from farther than that.
Well, moving to the last auction, which is mine, continuing my trend over the last couple of shows of sort of cheating. Basically, it's the search term Zenith in the vintage computer category. Let's see. Yep, that's about it. Done with pictures only. I was trying to think of something to a good auction to highlight, and so I did Zenith. I ultimately did Heath and then Zenith, but then this kind of struck my interest. There's only 26 results as of the moment. Look at the prices on these things.
Yeah, there's a 386 Zenith for $300.
Oh, I see it. Yeah, 386 SX.
Ooh, yeah, it has a 2 GB SCSI hard drive. Wow.
Like, one of the ones that, I mean, first off, the very first one, upper left, again, at the moment, or recording this, on Saturday, is the Zenith Data Station Super Sport Portable. $799?
Jeez,
I wonder if a lot of these are, oh, look, another zero per seller, Auburn, Massachusetts.
Yeah, those are weird.
But a little crazy, the Heathkit Zenith H100, I mean, that's a pretty interesting older machine. $699. Now, this person, I think, who's selling it, Vintage Computer Museum, they're in East Aurora, New York. Do you know who that is, Evan?
I don't, that person is a big-time seller. I know
that. And they're
selling
things for, like, crazy prices, aren't they?
Yeah, they've been around for a long time.
Yeah.
That far in New York is nowhere near where we are down here. That's, like, far away. But that, I'd like to know who they are, because that person seems to have a huge inventory and huge prices.
Oh, yeah.
So
he's got 140. If you click off to see more of his items, he or she, they have 147 items. And just
who it is a big black box to me. I have no idea.
Yeah.
And I've tried emailing them saying, hey, who are you? Work with us.
Everything's $800, $1,000.
And there's no reply. So
here's the Exidy Sorcerer Z80 for $999.
See the picture? They have a huge collection, their pictures, on their store, if you go to their eBay store.
Yeah.
Whoever it was must have started collecting a long, long time ago, and it's clearly not anybody who participates in CC Talk or anything. It's not somebody any of us know. So it must have been someone who was very, very farsighted a long time ago.
We've had this discussion on other shows with the eBay items, but, talk about making investments, so maybe that's all this stuff is to that person.
I think so. Or it could just be somebody who was in the computer field and had a huge collection and is trying to retire on it.
Yeah.
Somebody who didn't necessarily get it to – I don't think it's somebody who got it to sell it 30 years later. I think it's somebody who had all this stuff and realized, hey, I'm going to dole it out and I'm going to do the best I can.
And kind of sit slow with it, put it at high prices, and then,
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good strategy.
Really has a lot of stuff and a lot of patience and is not interested in participating in the community.
So anyway, Zeniths are pretty valuable, apparently, nowadays.
I think I had a Zenith and I threw it out. Whoops. But it was so filthy. I mean, it was rusted. It was really bad. I got it from a lady out of her basement. She had a couple of – actually, she was the one I got my K-Pro 2 from. And she had a whole stack of ones. Her brother had passed away, and it was down in the basement. But, it was just – there was seepage around it, and it was just – it was nasty, the systems. And the K-Pro was about the best one. So the Zenith, I think I just threw out.
Yeah, as I say, I've been there. I've been in that situation. So obviously you took it though, right? Because you felt like, I'm kind of obligated to dispose of this for this person.
And I couldn't get it I couldn't actually get it working. It was it wouldn't work, and it was really nasty. So I just chunked it.
I picked up a bunch of Macs one time, and I have the pictures, posted on the Retro Maccast on their Ning page or whatever. But these are the most yellow. These are like SEs and Pluses, the most yellow computers I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
And they even started a debate like whether this was painted, whether someone painted these things versus they discolored. Because they were like under a tarp outside.
Man. Mm.
So they'd been weathered,
So RetroBrite wasn't going to fix those up, huh?
I don't think so.
It's interesting, though, the Vintage Computer Museum seller, I mean, one of the things that they do have is an Epson QX10 that looks in really nice condition. It's a very niche computer, but when I worked at Epson, this is the, one of the computers that I worked on and supported.
Okay.
And the prices, for the auctions might be a little high, but if you're looking for a particular something, like in this case, I don't know anybody else. I've looked and looked, and I haven't seen other people selling an Epson QX10 in this kind of wonderful condition. So right. If I really wanted it, I would plunk down the $400 and buy it from this person, because that it would be the choice of doing that or maybe going without.
And, you know, and $400, I guess, is it's kind of at the threshold where it's not that crazy.
Right.
You know, but it's a lot of money, and, you know, is it really worth it or not? Well, depends on how much time you have, and right. But it's kind of, you know, like he also has a Hyperion, which is a very interesting, you know, old DOS portable, very cool looking, in fact. There's so many on here, I know it's hard to find. I was just trying to find that Epson.
The Hyperion is interesting because it's 1982, I believe, and a lot of people generalized the compact portable from 83 as being the first that was fully IBM compatible. In fact, it was a Dynalogic Hyperion.
Really?
Yes.
$499. So, you know, still quite a bit.
More than I would pay for it, but everything on that guy's store is more than I would pay for it.
The last thing on the Zenith, just to mention, is probably one of the best deals is here's a vintage Zenith Data Systems 8088 computer. You know, very generic early PC XT clone. It's in the box, though, and of course they say it's rare. Comes with keyboard, looks clean, powers on, posts. But for $75, buy it now. I mean, you know, for an old PC clone like that, that's actually not too bad. It's pretty hard to find those now.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, guys, I guess we've gone over. That happens.
A little bit.
It's fun. It's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much, as always. It's good to have everybody on. And anybody have anything to close out with?
Yeah, I got a fun rescue story here.
Okay.
Some, you know, in my club, a lot of people just kind of find us as we've been around for about 6 years. People just tend to find us. And let's see, about a month ago, somebody's brother was a young man in his mid-40s or so, was killed in a car accident or something. So his sister became, you know, the executor of his estate. And this guy was... worked at a lot of local computer companies. He was nobody famous, but he spent many, many years in computer field out here in central New Jersey. And so the sister contacted someone she knew who was a computer person out here in the 70s, who was of some local notoriety. And that person said, oh, we'll contact Evans Club. They're interested in that stuff. And man, good thing they did. We were told that they had a PDP-10 and an IBM 1130 mainframe. So we were just, you know, lusting over this. So we went to visit a few weeks ago. There was no PDP-10. I don't know where they got that from. But there was, in fact, an IBM 1130 mainframe. So a couple of days ago, myself and two other guys are here. We rented a 16-foot box truck using our club's budget. Went to this guy's house and failed the box truck. We could have made two more trips. The highlight of it was his IBM 1130 mainframe. The throw-ins were things we would have lusted after any other time. Just the throw-ins, a PDP-8E was a throw-in. There were three IBM 029 key punches as throw-ins. There were a dozen ASR-33s, a couple older telephones, like the giant, you know, mailbox size units. I don't even know the model numbers. There were a dozen or so terminals, everything from Hazeltines, Teledynes, VT-100s. There was... Oh, this guy, his house, he must have, no exaggeration, three or four dozen AT&T 3B2s.
What were they again?
AT&T 3B2s.
The old Unix boxes, right?
Unix box, yeah. And there were also some AT&T 6300 Unix PCs. So we're not going to get all those. You know, we don't need four dozen 3B2s. We'll get a few of them, some of the models we don't already have. There was an Altair and an MSI, one of each he's keeping. But... Wow. Again, I mean, we went to rescue an IBM mainframe, and the throw-in was a PDP-80. So,
wow. It's a huge find.
It was an amazing find.
Wow.
And it was all just given to us.
That's amazing. Wow. That's really cool.
Yeah. So we're very excited about that. Also, every room of this guy's house was full of computer equipment. And we have to go back another time with SUVs and minivans and stuff. We haven't even begun to touch... the books and manuals and software and accessories and terminals. We only got the big hardware so far. The 1130 came with original source on tape.
Wow.
And original set of manuals. So we contacted the guys at IBM1130.org, and they said they're so excited about this, they might even fly out for VZF and just to see it.
Wow.
The one we got is not going to run again. We had too much rust. It's too beat up. We'll try to pretty up as best we can. And it was really a heck of a rescue. Probably one of the top two or three rescues I've ever been on.
it's amazing what you just can imagine what people have in their collection, you know, that you just never know about until they pass away. And then you just there's no guarantee that their executor would contact a group.
Right. I mean, this guy, you know, happened to die in a car crash, but he was only in his mid-40s. So he could have lived easily the 30, 40, 50 years before he unloaded any of this stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
And again, if by pure coincidence, his wife and brother-in-law happened to know someone who was a big wig out here in the 70s in computers, and that person happened to know about my group.
Wow.
They could have just easily tried to eBay it, scrap it, who knows what. So
yeah,
it was pure luck. I mean, I know people say they make, you know, you make your own luck. But in fact, my group's around 6 years, you know, people got to know us and we created our luck in this case. But it was just an amazing rescue.
Yeah, it brings up an interesting discussion too about, you know, there's lots of people, other people that collect all kinds of other, we'll use the term obscure things. That
mm-hmm.
in their own little ecosystem, they're valuable and collectible and worth something. And, you know, and I'm sure this happens a lot where someone has a collection and they die, and then other people have no idea or, you know, they don't see, well, you know, they're cleaning out their house, and this is obviously junk here.
Right.
Well, why
I mean,
do you hear so much
also,
about this junk? We don't know, but yeah, okay, carry it out to the road.
There's a lot of people I've met who are computer collectors and think they're the only one.
Yeah.
They don't. Or a lot of people are accumulators, not collectors. An accumulator, a little pun there as well. thank you, computer science fun. But a lot of people, I mean, that's how I got in the hobby. A lot of people get in the hobby that way, is they think they're the only one. Never even. It's not that they think they're the only one. A lot of people collect or accumulate vintage computers, and it just never occurs to them that there is an organized hobby out there. People
right.
just don't stop and think about it. But this guy's all the computer stuff was only one third of this guy's house. The other two thirds, he had just as much antique radio and antique telephone stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, the museum where my computer museum is based also has a telephony group and an antique radio group. So after we get what we want, I'm sending those other guys over there. But you're right, though. It was just a stroke of luck, but you know, we did sort of make our luck, because you never – and that's a little piece of advice I would give to collectors is ask. You know, you don't know what you're missing if you don't ask. And, you know, advertise in local – Bill Degnan, you know, puts an ad every week in his local Delaware newspaper, and people answer the ad.
It's funny because I know that if I start doing that, I'll start getting so much stuff. I won't have room, and my wife will just kill me.
Yeah.
Well, we had
a situation that, you know, a couple years ago where we just got overwhelmed with 8-bit micros, you know. And eventually we started turning some of them away because it was too many.
True.
And we realized, you know, we're turning stuff away that we lost after 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I have a choice between 16 more Commodore 128s and an IBM 1130, there's no doubt which one I'm taking.
Right.
At the same time, you know, we're not, we'd rather take stuff and have it be overfilling our warehouse than see it get thrown away.
Right. There, and there was a time when I worked at a place and they were really replacing a lot of their old systems. And I had, you know, a dozen, probably 386, 486 machines. And I just started throwing them out because I'm like, okay, I've got one. I think that's all I need, you know, one of this model, you know, and I don't need five different versions, you know, or five different models of a 386 or 486. You know, I'm gonna keep my K Pro 2. I'm going to keep, you know, a Mac LC, you know, just try to have one of each, you know. So,
yeah,
David, you know, Rob O'Hara, who has been on, I think Earl interviewed him. He wrote the Commodore book.
Jason Scott includes that
in his book, right, with the BBS documentary DVD.
Oh, he has a bundle.
He has like 10 Commodore 64s. Now, they're good. I would say it's good to have multiple, you know, models for parts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, if you're going to replace, you're going to try to restore one model. So, you know, it's good to have sometimes to have multiple copies just in case for parts. So
I think it's like in his case, you know, the Commodore 64, if it's a significant machine that, you know, then sure, we'll have a few of them. But right, depending on your lifestyle and anything else, there's a limit. And there's also, like in my case, the realization that, like say, I've been working on all my Macs. I've been getting them all out, kind of going through them. I just had a machine fail, a 2CI, where I fired it up, everything's cool with it, checking it out, turn it off, put it aside, look at another one. Then I'm going through different hard drives and floppies and stuff, and then I fire it back up, and it smells like something burning, and now it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, yeah. You probably lost a capacitor
or something. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a Mac LC2. It's the only Mac I have, and I just got it out today. I know you're into Macs, and it was working, but now it looks like the screen, you know, just goes fuzzy, or it'll start to flip.
I mean, that's the thing. It's inevitably, this stuff is all going to fail.
Yeah,
and it's all hardware, and like Evan, you're talking about the PDP though. It'd be nice if you could fire it up and show it off, but it kind of like in that case, yeah, you clean it up and it just to look at it is a significant thing too.
It was the IBM 1130 that was
sorry.
Up. Actually, the PDP AE that we got in this rescue was actually one of the cleanest things in the rescue.
Oh, okay.
But
again, and
our straight eight that we got a couple years ago came out of a barn. And it was owned by a blind man.
Wow.
So he didn't know how filthy it was. And we opened it up, and there was an actual mouse nest inside of it.
Oh, wow.
We never found a mouse, but we found a mouse nest. And it came with an IBM plotter. So I said, look, it's got a mouse and a graphical interface.
That's good.
Except the mouse ran off.
It left its pad, though.
Yeah, there you go.
It was terrible. Hey, the last thing I want to mention, though, before we close out is the VCF E7.0 website just went live 2 days ago.
I saw that.
Now, there are plenty of errors on the site right now. We use a template from a past year, so we have to correct a bunch of stuff. So please bear with us if you find errors or email us and point them out. It will be fixed. And there might be some registration bugs, whatever else that, you know, us and Salam are working on still. So, but anyway, the site is up there and it's sort of kind of working right now.
Okay.
And that would be vintage.org.
And so, Matt, do you think you're doing any more boring beige boxes or?
Yeah. You know, the hard thing obviously is, and I know Earl goes to this, is, topics, you know, coming up with something to discuss. And, you know, so it's always kind of a challenge to think of something. Obviously, it's a huge, you know, amount of things you can pull from. But, you know, you don't want to repeat yourself or kind of go over the same thing. So, you know, it's tough with podcasting. I think that the podcasts that really kind of survive are ones that have multiple hosts and that do interviews.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think that's why Earl has done well with because of interviewing. And, you know, obviously having multiple hosts like you do, David, is a good thing. So, you know, it can be a challenge when it's just yourself. But, you know, being, you know, on your show and talking to you, it's kind of helped me to get motivated again. So we'll see. You know, the eBay stuff, I'd kind of forgotten about all the vintage stuff on eBay. So that might be good to kind of talk about. And I'm amazed at some of these machines that I have that I've gotten so cheaply. People are selling them for crazy prices now. I'm like, has it been that long since I've, you know, gone out and looked for these old machines? So,
it's definitely hard. Like I have not updated my classic computing podcast, one that I did myself, even though I do intend to, but I'm going to make it much shorter because this has kind of become the more, you know, main vehicle podcasts. Because, yeah, I'm not good at talking by myself. I'm willing to just use the video one. This kind of is a show and tell. So, so frankly, I'm behind on that. And even trying to get the Stan Veit book. I've been almost done with chapter 4 forever, so I'm trying to finish that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is that every good thing comes to an end, not to be cliche-ish, but, you know, the boring beige box stands out there, and they're still good to listen to. So if you never did another one, it doesn't take away from the good ones that you did. And at some point, this is going to end, and everything ends. And
I can attest to that, because you guys may remember, especially Earl and David, from January 04 to spring 06, so about 2 and 1/3 years, I did a weekly email newsletter for the hobby.
Right.
And after more than 2 years, it got to be like work every week.
Right.
And I tried doing it as a blog for a while. I was on computer all for a while, but it just got too much work.
Yeah.
And at that point, it stopped being fun. And I was also running out of topics, you know?
Yep. I think that's with any type of creative endeavor that you do, you're going to get bored with it. And
David, I'm sure you know, of course, you know, you used to do Historically Brewed. And, you know, Mike Nadeau did his thing. And without a profit, which is, you know, people have tried and many of us have tried, you, me, Mike, the guys a couple years ago who did the Colossi magazine, I forget what it was called, in the UK, because there's just – It gets to be hard to keep up quality, and there's not money in it, and you have to eventually you say, you know what, enough, let someone else pick up the mantle.
And Matt, early on, I think you said you had a child. You have one child?
Yeah, I have a daughter. She's 2.5.
So, you know, this is what happened to me.
Yeah.
Is I was all fired up, you know, and I we had one child, you know, just born, and I started my newsletter. So that was cool. But then,
you get busy.
Yeah, then had a second child, and then, you know, yeah, life gets even more complicated, and life just gets in the way a lot, and it's, you know.
You get busy. I mean, when I was in college, like I said, I was really big into collecting old video games, and I would go every weekend to the flea markets, and, you know, I would hang out with friends at work, and we would play the games, and we'd do stuff on eBay, and I was in this IRC chat group, and we were, you know, really big into it, and I had lots of time to do it. You know, nowadays – your weekends are filled with doing different things with the kids and the family, and I don't say one or other, you know, family is much more important for me, but when you do have the time, you know, you really want to pick something that you're really interested in and motivated by. So, you know, so it always fluctuates. But I think it's to have these podcasts, to have any type of creative effort that you do, have it out there, leave it out there. Don't let it get deleted. Someone will find it and enjoy it, even if you're not keeping up with it.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. But, you know, you're welcome. I'll be inviting you back.
Oh, sure.
If you want to. You can always have, you know, be on this show and indulge in
definitely,
computer
definitely.
History stuff.
I mean, we're all geeks, and we like talking about technology, old or new, you know, so it's definitely cool.
And, Earl, so you said you're working on your next Retro Bits.
I am just a little behind on schedule, and I'm going to, you know, echo
no
what you guys
necessary.
Are saying. And with me, I'd have to say that, you know, given the eclectic nature of the stuff that I cover, it's not so much about topics as it is discretionary time, like mm-hmm. you guys are saying. It's just, right. you know, what is this life thing that keeps getting in the way of my hobby? But,
some people that their hobby is their job and their lives, you know, that's pretty enviable.
Yeah. Well, I'm fortunate enough to work in technology, you know, to be able to work in the love of my life, you know, from that perspective. So definitely happy about that. But have been actually being able to break free a little bit more here recently, among other things, like I was mentioning the first part of the podcast, playing with the Commodore stuff. And also I'm going through a book that I used to have in the 80s, Peter Norton's assembly language book for the IBM PC. It's a great book. I had it in the 80s and I loved it then. And, you know, of course, it's, you know, 20-some years later, and somebody had it on FreeCycle, you know, just giving it away, so I got it. And I'm going through it again. It's in great condition. I got, you know, my PC to actually go through it on the old hardware. So I'm doing it for real again. It's just, you know, obviously for fun. I don't think there's going to be any money in it.
But, you know, Earl, the great thing about your podcast is whatever topic I'm – if it's related to retro computing, if there's anything I'm interested in, I can just load up my iPod and just pick the different episodes. You know, it's such a wide range that you cover. It's just whatever you can think of, you know, it's like you've probably covered it. So it's enjoyable.
You ought to see if you can interview Peter Norton. I have no idea if he – could do that
is an awesome idea. I'm going to see if I... David, that's genius. I'm going to see if I can track him down if he'd be willing to do that. Thank you.
Bell went off in my head.
You probably could. I mean, you probably could get in touch. I mean, a lot of these guys are just, you know, retired or, you know, they're not really... I mean, I don't know how busy they are, but, you know, it would be cool to definitely
well,
do.
Well, one of the people that I subscribe to on Twitter... I may also try and get in contact with. I don't know if he'd be interested, but Dan Bricklin.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's still actively working in, you know, software stuff, and he tweets pretty regularly. So see if I could reach him, too. But, yeah, it's been fun. It's been a lot of different stuff. And it's funny. I get emails all the time from people who say, hey, I just found your podcast, and I'm, you know, starting to go through them. And I'm kind of wondering, how did they find it? What search did they use? You know, I do Google alerts to see if I can figure out how people are finding it. But
there's still a lot of people just discovering podcasts even now just through iTunes.
I think that's true.
So
yeah, I don't think it's like kind of when Earl started, that was really the big surge of podcasting, and it kind of died out a little bit as far as from a hobbyist perspective. But yeah, it's neat.
I agree.
It's interesting to know that people would find your podcast, you know, so many years later, and if they're just getting started, it's a lot to go through.
Yeah, but it's a body of work that stands.
And, it is.
And it's still good. It doesn't matter that it's, you know, how often you do it now or how old it is or anything.
Well, just with Earl's, like if I was interested in BBSs, I would go back and pick up part one and part two to listen to that topic. So it's not really linear. You know, you can just pick up different episodes, whatever you're interested in. So
yeah, just like my favorite documentaries from 1992. So okay, it stops there, but it doesn't change how good it is and what it covered about the past.
Right, the history doesn't change unless somebody discovered something new that invalidated it or whatever. But
right.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I got to drop. My daughter just woke up from a nap, and
no
she's
problem.
Crying.
My family needs their internet back.
Okay. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, David, so much.
No problem. Talk to you soon.
Bye, guys.
Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye. So I'm going too, guys.
All right.
Thanks a lot. Sorry it went so long. See how editing goes. It's going to be a long one.
All right, take care.
You guys take care. Talk to you again soon.
See ya.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'd like to again thank Earl Evans of RetroBits, Evan Koblenz of March, and the Vintage Computer Festival East. I'm going to VCF East this year, so I'd love to meet you, the listeners. Plus, thanks to Matt Wilson of Boring Beige Box. Please also check out my other two podcasts, the Classic Computing Video Podcast and Stampede's History of the Personal Computer Audiobook Podcast. All three of my podcasts can be subscribed to through iTunes. Please help me out by leaving a review in the iTunes store. There's also a link on every podcast page where you can download any podcast directly. You can also help support the shows by donating through PayPal. A link is at the bottom of the show notes page. Plus, you can support the shows by using my Amazon.com links for books mentioned and with the search box. Read my blog and follow everything I'm doing at classiccomputing.com and on Twitter. I'd love to hear from you too, so email me at david@classiccomputing.com. Guys, hold on just a second. I'm sorry. I don't want to yell into the microphone. Oh, Tamara, will you chase Trouble down over there? He keeps eating the whatever it is. Our cat.
He called him. His name's Trouble?
Yeah. he's a good cat. But
well, that was your mistake right there then.
Well,
naming him Trouble.
we didn't name him. We actually adopted him when he was five. So, and it's a funny story there is he... It was at a PetSmart, and you know they had the cats in there, and they had his name as Treble, T-R-E-B-L-E, and I guess because they thought people wouldn't want to adopt a cat named Trouble, so after we adopted him, then they told us, oh, his real name's Trouble. But he's been a great cat, but yeah, he'll chew on. It's like
they had it spelled Treble, like
yeah.
He's really a high pitched cat.
I guess. But he'll chew on, like we have a Christmas wreath laying around that we need to put away with the other Christmas stuff, and he's chewing on it all the time. So we're going to get him some, you know, cat grass today. All right.